We get things started by welcoming in our friend, writer and critic, Colin Fleming. Colin, a good Tuesday afternoon.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Well, no, I've got some aches and pains. I'm not going to just put a big old heart around it and say everything's great, which is kind of what you wrote about this week in the Wall Street Journal with a terrific piece called Don't Clam Up When Life Brings You Down.
Right. Well, you can just slather yourself in some Bengay for those aches and pains. That's what I've been doing lately. But yeah, the Wall Street Journal piece was about something that I think we spend so much time right now pretending, sort of this stagecraft that our lives are so wonderful. It's quite enervating, really, isn't it, to always be telling people, usually via social media, how happy and sunshiny your life is, and that it has nothing to do with nullity or gaping maw of emptiness or pain or just very human things of having a tough kind of go of it, which I think we have more of these days in a world where we have less friends, really, than we've ever had before, because we are so focused on that stagecraft, putting out there that stage presentation. And we all see people on social media, and people we know in our lives. We actually know them. They're in our family. They're our cousin. We saw them at the baby's bris or whatever it was. And we know how they're doing. But then we come home, and we log on to the Facebook, and we see this campaign of joy about how wonderful life is. And it's like, you don't need to do that. You're not helping yourself out.
So why do you think people do that, Colin? Is it because they're trying to convince themselves of how happy they are? Or is it that maybe desire to not burden other people with your troubles?
Oh, I don't think people are so aware of other people that they're really that invested or concerned with whom they might burden. I don't think they're even thinking in terms of their fellow person that way. I think they tend to be locked in on themselves with blinders, like a horse has on when you see it going down the street. So it can't look to the left, it can't look to the right. It's not like it's so focused on the road ahead. It's just kind of pushing itself through its latest excursion. And I think there's a lot of that. I think there's kind of an element of wish fulfillment where people, you know, when they say this and they post it over and over again, you do get that feeling of like, okay, dude, who are you trying to convince here? Or say it enough times and it might be true. It's like you're given this genie lamp, and rather than just like, well, I can rub this three times, you're like, I am going to rub the hell out of this sucker. I am going to break down the metal until this genie gives me what I want, and he's just going to be worn down by my advances. And I think it's something that does end up burdening people even more, because we have to process people's BS. We have to sort of work through the walls they've put up or find a way to circumvent these walls. And if we care about that person, we don't want to deal with their walls. We want to deal with them. And then when we deal with them, they can deal with us, and they help us out as well. And that is being lost. We are becoming more and more disconnected and alone, and more than invested in this horrible stagecraft.
And as you point out in your piece in the Wall Street Journal, when you do go with candor and honesty and share that maybe things aren't all rosy, sometimes that can forge some new and even stronger relationships with people.
Exactly. I had a year of my life, and actually it's gotten worse since, but I had a year of my life where I cried in front of a lot of people in public. It was something I was doing in courthouses. It was something I was doing in front of family. It was something I was doing in front of friends. It was something I was doing just when I'd gotten through maybe a courtroom appearance or something like that that I had to deal with because of a divorce, where I'm at the Starbucks and I'm practically breaking down. And I came to realize, too, that in talking about this or in saying what I was going through, there was not a single person. There's not a single person out there right now thinking it, who's listening to this, who's saying, what a weak bastard that guy is. They're thinking the opposite. They're thinking, huh, he's just that comfortable talking about it. He's owning it. You have to be pretty secure in yourself, have a degree of self-awareness that I think is past what a lot of people have right now, to be able to own that. No one's going to think you're weak. They're going to think you're impressive. They're actually going to be intimidated by you, but they're going to be personally emboldened by you as well. And a friendship can come from that, and it helps people. Because when we're just pretending, no one is helping anyone else out, and we become these sort of drones who, it's not about what we are as humans. We're entering into a sort of post-humanity, where it's not about the is, it's about the perception. And the perception is that center, right, that Yeats would say can never hold. And I think that's where it's gotten us to.
And we become, I always think of hockey game, youth hockey games, especially of kids going through the line, mindlessly high-fiving and saying, good game, good game, good game, good game. And we've become in many ways that as a society. How are you doing? Great. How are you doing? Oh, living the dream. How are you doing? Fantastic. Thank you. Nobody opens the door and lets anybody in. And I think there's a wonderful piece in your Wall Street Journal column where you talk about the bartender and the assumption you have that he's doing a lot better than you are.
Sure, I started going to a bar here in Boston, colonial-era bar called Durgan Park. It's been around forever. In fact, I got the idea for a novel there that would be told entirely in conversation between a guy named Ryder, a guy named Bartender. Ryder thinks he's dead and in hell. He just hasn't been apprised of that officially yet. And this totally pervy guy from the suburbs who dresses up as Ben Franklin. Now, none of this actually transpired when I went, but there was a bartender. And I was sitting there one time, and I'd come in every Sunday. It was just something I did to try and get, like, not even so much a routine back, but a way to not take the train up to the North Shore and put myself in front of a train. It was just a way to try and keep going, to sort of find this routine in my life. And part of that was going to this bar on Sunday. And he just said to me casually one day that he was on unemployment and he couldn't get regular work in his field. We were the same age exactly, and he only had this bartending gig. It was just 2 days a week. And I just thought, you know, that was really cool. It wasn't something that didn't occur to me that I would sort of suppress if I had my thing. I mean, I was talking about what my given thing was, which is just different. But I just remember when he said to me, thinking, you know what, that's really rare. People aren't doing what he just did here. And what I guess I'm doing subsequently with people out in the world. And I didn't think, like, ha, you plonker, look at you, get me a Mighty Samuel Adams, you loser, can't even get a job in the real estate and do my bidding. And I never thought anything like that for a second. I never thought this person was weak. I thought this person was impressive. And it also made it easier for me to talk, maybe not just to this person, but even to myself, to be like, you know what, no one is going to think less of you. And you need some help right now, and everyone needs some help right now, and this is a way we can sort of go about looking after each other. And it just makes life less tedious. It makes it more real. People want things to be real, but they're scared to allow them to be real.
And there's no more unreal place than social media, as you mentioned, but there are also people out there then, and maybe this is part of their need that they have to do this, who use social media quite often to get validation. And we'll talk about how awful things are going and how they're being treated poorly. And you know, once in a while, it's nice to see that level of candor. But they're also, and we probably all got friends who do this on social media, who want you to tell them that everything's okay. And that gets a bit tiring sometimes.
I wonder, like, how many people you'd have to go through who are on social media to find a person who doesn't use it for that kind of desperate validation seeking. I wonder, like, how many people ever use it because, well, you know what, I am keeping a diary, and this is my online diary, come hell or high water, this is my thing, this is sort of for my own thoughts, so I can marshal my intellect and my emotions, try to process what I'm going through, and being online makes me more apt to do that. I bet you'd have to go through a million people to find someone who's using it for a reason that's some degree of healthy. I don't think it's out there. We're more depressed than ever. We're more alone than ever. And gee, what does that kind of like simultaneously sync up with? The development of this social media.
Well, and as a teacher, I see that all the time. We've got more kids depressed than ever. And I think part of that is because of the incredible amount of time they spend on social media, where they see people pretending to have these happy, wonderful lives, which very few people have when they're going through post-adolescence. And that's got to be difficult to maneuver, because they don't always know how to interpret that and see what's BS and the little bit that might actually be reality.
There is a time in life, there are many times in a person's life where things can overwhelm you. And the way to deal with them, to begin to have a chance to deal with them, is you flip this switch. And that switch is one that basically turns the lights off to say, okay, right, this halts now. I am going to take stock of what is going on, and then I am going to charge into the breach harder than I've ever charged into it before, but better equipped because I've done some stock taking. You don't get to take the stock when you are constantly surrounded by this digital wallpapering. It's always just there in front of your face. It's like when you go to the museum, you're at the MFA, and you walk over to the Jackson Pollock, you don't stick your beak right in those fractals. You need to move back and be like, oh, that's what he's doing with this drip technique, and I see this better now. But we always have the beak right in this all the time now. And you could be strong enough mentally that at the same time, you could sort of in your head be like, oh, okay, I see this, but I also see the perspective. But that's not really how we're wired. That's how Socrates was wired. That's not how Jim the greengrocer and Sally the lawyer are wired. That's different. You need to be able to have the halting, and then we get caught up in this perpetual never halting, and the cycle just builds and builds and builds and builds.
Really thought-provoking piece. You can find it online at WSJ.com, and of course you can check out all of Colin's work at his website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Colin, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.